It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. If we must fail, let us fail at high endeavors. Let us not fail to be mediocre when we could fail to be absolutely brilliant. Let us not fall short of being moderately compassionate. Let us rather fall short of being wellsprings of love. Of all our failures in life, perhaps the saddest are those in which we failed even to try and serve the highest and noblest ideals. It is a sin to fail at low aims, not because we failed, but because we aimed so low. But it is not a sin to fail at very high aims, like aiming for truth, justice, compassion, and character. Because even our failure puts us into the company of the saints, the company of those who also believe that rising to our full humanity and rising to our full divinity may be the same rising. Striving after low and paltry ends is a boring sin, not worthy of us. Let us have greater ambition for our shortcomings. Let us vow never to fail at anything that wasn't noble or proud, never to accept lower aspirations for ourselves, our lives, our country, or our world. We confess that we will all fail, but let it not be a failure of vision or a failure of aspiration. If we must fail, let us fail at high endeavors, and then let those failures bless us, for they will. Amen.
That was to see if you're alive. This is the first time I'm trying a theme approach to sermons. I've decided that I'll do one sermon each month on a theme, probably always a one-word theme for no reason. And the idea of the themes is that they're life-based. They're things that aren't keyed to any religion, but everyone who lives experiences these things. And we'll have a series of 36 themes that we're working out, one for each month on a three-year cycle, like Christian churches use a lectionary, and we'll go through the whole cycle. So this is the first, and it's on the word salvation. Now, I know that's a word that might make some of you run screaming up the walls because you've had it soaked in so many bad associations from perhaps a bad religious background or just the whole idea that religion is some kind of a disease of the mind, and salvation is one of the symptoms of it. Actually, it's a pretty safe word. It's a very down-to-earth word, and it's a word that belongs anywhere with liberals, with people without a religion, and people with a religion. It comes from Latin words that really have kind of two meanings. It does come from a Latin word meaning to save, but it's also the same root that we have in our word salve. It's a kind of health. It's a kind of wholeness that it's about. Salvation is about finding a healthy kind of wholeness. And there isn't anybody who doesn't need that. It's about serving and being defined by, to put it another way, big ideals rather than small ones. Being part of a big story, a big picture, rather than a small one. I talked about this in yesterday morning's sermon by quoting from a lot of ancient sources of religions all over the world. But since most of you weren't there yesterday morning, I'll do it differently this morning by talking about some stories, which are probably more fun than a lot of ancient quotations, except for those few academics who still believe in salvation by bibliography. So these stories, the big stories, that first big story on size was written over 30 years ago by a liberal theologian named Bernard Loomer. He was dean of the University of Chicago Divinity School for a decade, and then he finished his career teaching religion in California, where he also began attending and joined a Unitarian church. Some people may think he was one of us because he once joined a Unitarian church. I don't care what church he joined. I think he was one of us because he understood just what kind of size matters and why it must be a commanding presence in our lives. And that touching story of the young Yehudi Menuhin. Now, if he'd been given an 18th century Guarneri violin for his fourth birthday, like the one he played later in his career, he wouldn't have done justice to it. An instrument like that really takes your measure. To pick up a first-rate violin and then just fiddle around with it can mark you as some sort of a tourist or a fool. It's dangerous sometimes to pick up a first-rate instrument unless you're willing to be serious with it. But that violin would have been good enough that he could have spent years growing into it, and even someone with his gifts would never be likely to outgrow a first-rate instrument. And then that peasant woman, the peasant woman in the cathedral. Her job was bigger than the job of the carpenters and the stonemasons. Not bigger in the sense that it was more important to the cathedral, but bigger in the sense that it was more important to her. She lived in a world where her simple role was part of a calling that transcended even her time and place. And living within a perspective that big absolutely blesses us. It doesn't require great talent, only a great soul. The carpenters and the stonemasons were connected in their imaginations only to petty causes, building pews, or just feeling smug because they belonged to a cool club. And whatever satisfactions or gifts they could get from that would have to be equally shallow. We need more than that. All three of these stories are metaphors. And I want to add a fourth story to bring them together and tie them to religion and to us. This is a true story. 15 to 20 years ago, I belonged to an ecumenical ministers group of about 40 ministers. It was called Grace Luncheon. And every Thursday, we ate lunch together. The churches in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I was, the churches took turns hosting this. So we were at a different church every week. And often, I had trouble finding them because I can't read a map. And so I would often start out early to make sure I could find the church on time. And this Thursday, we were going to meet at a small, rural Presbyterian church that I was sure I'd never find. So I left early, and I found out after I got on the road, the church was actually quite close and very easy to find. So I got there half an hour early. I entered in the middle of a very heated conversation between the three women who were setting up the tables and getting the lunch ready. And so I tried to be very quiet and sort of invisible and slink down into a table so they wouldn't see me, and I tried to pretend to ignore them so they'd keep talking because I wanted to eavesdrop on what this very heated conversation was about. They had been trashing some religion, either Baptist or Catholic, and finally one of the three women exclaimed, "Well, thank God we're Presbyterians." There was a silence. The silence is what surprised me. And then after a few seconds, the second woman said, "I don't think we're supposed to be Presbyterians. I think we're supposed to be Christians." And there was another silence, which was even more surprising. And after a few more seconds, the third woman spoke. "No," she said, "even that's too small. We're just supposed to love one another, that's all." Not another word was spoken. That's a whole graduate school education in religion, right there. In this story, you have both first and second-rate instruments. Actually, that first woman, the mere Presbyterian, and I was raised Presbyterian, she was clutching about a third-rate fiddle. If she had a religion, it didn't show. She treated the church as a club, like the stonemasons in the other story, where just being around people like her made her superior to those damned Baptists and Catholics. If you asked her what these Presbyterians of hers believed, she may have done no better than giving you a half-memorized list of third-hand beliefs she had learned, the way you learned the rules of a sorority or the Elks Club. Like the little tin fiddle, there's no moral range here. There's a bad tone to it. And it couldn't even sound good if it were played well. If all she has is that sort of self-important hand-me-down identity of being a Presbyterian, whatever that means, you have to hope she'll be led around by somebody using a far better instrument in the service of a far bigger vision. Now, the second woman was also holding a toy instrument, though a larger one. Her second-hand identity was called Christian. If you asked her what she meant by that, she too would probably have recited kind of a tattered list of other people's beliefs. Maybe that list would include a set of prescribed chants on things like Jesus, God, the Bible, and maybe two or three special stories from the Bible. But the odds are they'd be someone else's beliefs, especially if she expressed them in the same words that everybody else in the club used. She would just be chanting. So she might have picked up the instrument, but she'd never actually practiced it. Once more, you'd hope she'd be led around by somebody coming from a much bigger and richer place if her actions are ever going to affect you and your world. But that third Presbyterian woman, she made music. You assume she must also belong to the Presbyterian Club and the Christian Club, but she wouldn't settle for such a paltry calling any more than the 4-year-old Yehudi Menuhin would pick up the tin fiddle. She made music because she was the only one who seemed to know that religion is about behavior, not belief. It's about being, not saying. Deeds, not creeds. After all, only members of our club or some rival club care what we believe. Nobody cares what we believe. Those are just turf battles. And doesn't conformity of belief show that we haven't thought any more deeply than the other club members? Is that a good thing, to have conformity of belief? It doesn't seem so. In any tradition, isn't that just the secondhand religion for their masses? Whether it's called Presbyterianism or, God forbid, Unitarian Universalism? It's exalting our group because they're our kind of people, isn't it? And isn't this a definition of narcissism? Those outside our club don't care at all what we believe. They just want to know whether we can sing them a song of active caring rather than a self-righteous little ditty. Now you see how this mixed metaphor of finding salvation by making big music on first-rate instruments can work in religion. It really works pretty well. But it's more complex in religion. Because religion has a dimension that has to command us. Honest religion isn't about anything as shallow as belief. You all know that. It's about who we most deeply are, need to become, and how we need to live. And you can prove this within yourselves right now. That's how powerful this is. You will prove this within yourselves right now because you knew when you heard the story of those three women that only the third woman got it. And I suspect you may also have felt that there's something wrong about posing as a religious person but not getting it. If not wrong, at least very incomplete and a little off the path. You know this. You're built this way. Almost all of us are built this way. I think that kind of awareness of integrity and authenticity are absolutely built into who we are and who we have to be if we're going to grow into our full humanity. So salvation is about that kind of size and that quality of spiritual vision that can make us not only content, but also useful rather than merely ornamental. In liberal religion, it's about digging deep enough to find the treasure, the spirit, rather than staying on a self-satisfied surface. You know what I mean by this. The spirit of liberal religion, which is always opposed to the spirit of literal religion. Change one letter, you change a whole world of possibilities in any religious tradition. That spirit is very old. I was talking about it yesterday morning. It's between 2,000 and 4,000 years old. It's not new at all, and it was born many places, just as it can be born in us. It was born in the Hindu Upanishads, where they saw that Brahman, which really meant the creative and sustaining and destructive forces of the universe, that Brahman is present in each of us just as the taste of salt is present throughout the ocean. A wonderful metaphor. It was born in the Buddha, who saw that the secret of life isn't about gods or supernatural end runs. It's available to all of us here and now if only we will wake up to life's less dramatic but more authentic possibilities. And if once awakened, we will understand, as the Buddha would say, that compassion is the only appropriate and life-enhancing response to all other creatures. The spirit of liberal religion was born at about the same time in some of the ancient Hebrew prophets who attacked the self-important rituals of the priests. They didn't like priests. And they said God wasn't interested in what we believe or how we bowed and scraped. God was only interested in how we treated one another especially the most vulnerable among us. That's a spirit of liberal religion. They're each slightly different, but they're coming from the same kind of soil. It was also born at least twice in China. First in Confucius, who was concerned not with gods, but with ourselves, here and now. And he saw that our mistake was that we conceived of ourselves as far too small, whereas our biggest and most necessary self only exists as part of the larger society around us. So our job, he thought, is to learn to care and respect for the relationships with others that make life flow smoothly. Wonderful. Lao Tzu also gave birth to the spirit of liberal religion, the spirit of deeds, not creeds, in Taoism, when he wrote one of the finest moral teachings in history, in any tradition. "What is a good man but a bad man's teacher?" he asked. "What is a bad man but a good man's job? If you don't understand this, you'll get lost. However intelligent you are, it is the great secret." It's hard to sum up an ethical program for living more concisely than that. The spirit of honest religion, of being human religiously, was born at the deepest and the most nuanced levels of all great religions and philosophies. And then more than 1,000 years before any of the rest of these, the spirit of liberal religion was born in the world's oldest story, the still magnificent story of Gilgamesh, that we should know better. He was a real person. He ruled over 4,700 years ago. And the earliest texts of this story go back over 4,100 years. It's the oldest story we have. They saw themselves as living in the modern age because writing had just been invented right there 100 years earlier. So they separated themselves from all those ancient primitive people who didn't have writing. And now as moderns, they ask themselves, this is hard to believe, 4,700 years ago. They ask themselves, of what use were the old gods to modern people? They decided that the gods had become sort of impotent ornaments, but that the meaning and purpose of life, which is now up to us, was still immeasurably rich and very close at hand through the deeds we do, the positive differences we make, the art and the music we create, the love and joy we can share with families and friends, and the influence we can have on those who will come after us. There in that most ancient story was a religious vision, I think, more courageous and more unfettered than that of any Western religion. It's grounded in life, not in teachings about it. You can feel how big all these ancient liberal visions are. It's a bigness that doesn't insult the human spirit by offering the religious equivalent of little tin fiddles. All of these were among the births of the multiple spirits of liberal religion. Any one of them, or any good combination of them, can offer a commanding vision big enough to let us feel that we are building a magnificent cathedral to the greater glory of God, or to the legitimate heir to what was once called God, as Gilgamesh, the Chinese, the Buddha, the Greeks, and many moderns would put it. That rich and ancient history is the tradition I stand within and I try to serve as a religious liberal. I'm not a Unitarian Universalist, and I hope you're not either. Now understand, I don't mean that in a cheap way. I mean it in an expensive way, in a demanding way. Denominational identities, or the banalities of creeds or sayings or principles or any of this, are too paltry to do justice to the yearnings of the human spirit, aren't they? They're little toy instruments on which no interesting music is ever going to be played, and which will drive the more aware and gifted people away from us, just as they did the 4-year-old Yehudi Menuhin. I suspect that tin fiddle spirituality is the main reason why we have lost almost 70% of our market share in the United States since 1961. 70%, it's a lot. And we still don't have many more members than we did then. We owe ourselves and our people this kind of spiritual and intellectual bigness. Not something to let us think we're smarter or more special than others, but something character-based and commanding. We each need to offer our people and our communities deep and nuanced spiritual instruments that can challenge even the most gifted among them, and an understanding of the human condition big enough both to contain our spirits, to empower them, and to command them. If what we offer can't take its place proudly among the world's most profound religions, we should be ashamed to offer it. In the end, it doesn't matter whether we call our spiritual center God or something else. What matters is whether we can call it forth. Whether we can call it forth and invite it into our lives and our churches and our world. The people who trust us need to feel that their best efforts are helping to build a magnificent cathedral to the greater glory of God or the legitimate heirs to what was once called God. That kind of a vision, that kind of an instrument is big. And that kind of size really matters. Salvation is about a healthy kind of wholeness that is buried within and among us, not on the surface, but deeper. As in the children's story, we first have to get beyond ourselves because it isn't about us. But always, after the road that leads us outward, there needs to be another that leads us back home. As T.S. Eliot put it so famously, so wonderfully, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. As a religious movement, we also need to get beyond our comfortable biases as social or political liberals, because it isn't about us either. It's about finding an avenue to a deep and true perspective on our life and on life itself, a perspective that can not only empower us but also command us. And if it is an honest and profound kind of liberal religion, of any religion, what it commands us to do is to dig, to find that treasure buried within, around, and among us, to arrive where we started and perhaps to know the place profoundly for the very first time. And then to do something, to come alive, to recognize that we are children of God. We are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself, and we are the best hope of our world. Then the transformation and the miracle of salvation has occurred. Then we have been born again, born of the Holy Spirit, born of the joy of life that has found us at last, and with that, a whole new world has begun. A whole new world has begun, and hallelujah.